I'm an associate medical director for field-based services at the Department of Mental Health. I supervise the home teams for DMH. I'm also one of the supervising psychiatrists that's helping develop Hollywood 2.0. And my expertise really lies in street psychiatry and how to adapt traditional psychiatry and deliver it for folks who are experiencing chronic unsheltered homelessness. The ultimate goal over here is to kind of illustrate the advancements that have taken place in psychiatry. It's come a long way to show how training is provided to psychiatrists, how uniquely we need to restructure how education is provided to psychiatrists who are working with this population, and the way when it comes to DMH, how home team and FSB in particular can be integrated to work as a unified spectrum of care. So with that overview, I'll jump into the presentation. So here we go. One of the key points of this presentation is for psychiatrists, based on their training, oftentimes don't fundamentally get taught the difference between people who are housed and people who are experiencing homelessness. A lot of the policies and standards of care that are taught in traditional psychiatry are designed for people who are housed. For example, you come into a hospital, you get stabilized, and you go out and follow up with your outpatient provider. Well, that model of care doesn't really work that well if you're experiencing homelessness and don't have the foundation of a home to really follow up with outpatient care. So at the very core of this is, if you're a psychiatrist, please understand that most of your training is designed for individuals coming. The protocols, you know, are designed for people who are housed. If you are working with an individual who is experiencing homelessness, you really have to think about how your treatment plan is actually going to be carried out, and not just develop a standard treatment plan that would work for an individual that's housed. You'll have to come up with a very customized treatment plan that's going to work for someone who is experiencing homelessness, and not a plan that someone who is experiencing homelessness will have to work for. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty, a little bit about mental health and homelessness. It was surprising to me when I first began working for the home team and working with homeless populations that there wasn't much data about psychiatric treatment being provided to people who were experiencing homelessness. There wasn't enough evidence-based studies that I could look at and figure out how I'm going to customize my treatment plans. But now thankfully, there's a lot of research going on with regards to homeless population and determining, you know, what kind of mental health conditions are we working with? What are the needs? What are the current systems that are in place? How are you going to manage the crisis? So I thought there was one particular study that I found that was interesting. It was a systematic review that was completed in 2021 that studied the prevalence of mental health disorders in clearly defined populations in high-income countries. They studied high-income countries because they actually had criteria that defined homeless populations a little bit better. But what they found was that 76% of people who were experiencing homelessness had a mental health disorder. When you look at the different types of disorders that were present, alcohol use disorder was at the highest at 37%. Personality disorders were actually also identified and graded as significantly high. You can anticipate how that's going to be true if you have a severe personality disorder where you're not able to really connect with individuals and rationally utilize resources, regulate your moods. It is going to result in inappropriate utilization of resources and ultimately homelessness. Drug-related disorders, we can imagine, are going to be pretty high. But here's what I want to point your attention to. Schizophrenia was at 12%. In the general population, schizophrenia is about at 1%. When you look at homeless population, it's a much higher percentage, which shows that the impairments of schizophrenia are so profound that it can result in people not utilizing resources, falling out of community, and ending up on the streets. The same thing with major depressive disorder. The rate of major depressive disorder in the general population is about 4 to 5%. It's more than double for those who are experiencing homelessness. Bipolar disorder is also pretty high, but about the same as the general population. What's more interesting is substance use disorders and psychiatric disorders preceded the onset of homelessness in the majority of people who were studied. What this really shows is that mental health impairments and homelessness are thus closely interrelated. And quite often, the mental health condition that's developing is what is one of the core reasons why homelessness is setting into place. You can't look at mental health without looking at physical health. That's equally important. Homeless individuals are susceptible to the same range of diseases as the general population, but in addition, they have long-term exposure to disease agents, overcrowding, they're in unsanitary conditions, there's poor nutrition, sleep deprivation, weather extremes, all types of trauma. What that really means is that they're susceptible to the same range of diseases, but they have much higher rates of chronic conditions, respiratory illnesses, disorders of skin, blood vessels, infections, physical trauma. What does this all mean when you put it together? Now you start looking at mortality. Because if you start having mental health impairments and physical health impairments, both of those are going to result in increased mortality rates. People who are experiencing homelessness are 36 times more likely to die from a drug overdose. That is the leading cause of death. Four times more likely to, and that's the leading cause of death in LA County. Every county might have some different parameters. Four times more likely to die from heart disease. That is the second leading cause of death. We're going to come back to that later. 17 times more likely to die from traffic-related injuries, increased rates of homicide and suicide. But this is the most important thing. The average age of death is around 40 to 50 years of age. That is an exceptionally early death. And what's even more concerning is around what age are most of your referrals coming to you when they're around 40 to 50 years of age? So that's why it's very time is life a little bit on the streets. And there is a sense of urgency to make interventions in a timely fashion. So you don't show up to, check on your client one day and they're no longer with us. You want to avoid a death on the streets as much as possible. So time is very important. Identifying individuals who are either at risk for homelessness or who are already experiencing homelessness is a priority, and we need timely management of physical and mental health conditions. So let's switch up a little bit, and I'm going to take you on a journey to show you what traditional psychiatric care looks like and how it doesn't really address the needs of people who are experiencing homelessness and why field-based services are important. So if you're a new psychiatrist and you're going into training, here are the three levels of care that your residency is going to primarily expose you to. You will start your training in the ER and inpatient unit, so you will become very familiar with acute psychiatry, inpatient stabilization. Once you're done with that, you'll move out to outpatient psychiatry. You'll learn how to manage mental health conditions in an outpatient setting and in a clinic. If you're lucky and interested in learning how residential psychiatric care is provided, and I mean mostly residential rehab, you might have some experience at a residential level of care where it's a community sort of living situation and psychiatric services are being offered. That's really it. There was no street psychiatry rotation. There is no field-based experience ready for provided to psychiatrists. And oftentimes psychiatrists going in field-based services don't have any formal training. They're just interested in providing care to that population. But only now has street psychiatry kind of established some roots. Field-based psychiatry is being taught about. The principles are being taught. But a lot of the folks who have stepped up to be in those roles haven't had any formal training on how to manage field-based services or to at least fully address the needs of homeless populations. So let's say you have these levels of care, and let me show you exactly how it fails. If you have someone who is experiencing street homelessness, can they walk into a clinic regularly and get medications? Not really. Some folks might be, but if you're truly impaired, you have poor insight and judgment, you're too busy focusing on survival, getting into an appointment at 9 a.m. might not be the priority for you. You might make a couple, but the risk of treatment fallout is going to be exceptionally high. At the same time, can you make it into residential care? No, you really can't, because if you want to make it into, for example, a boarding care, a licensed facility where you can get medical and psychiatric care, guess what? You need a physician's report, you need labs, you need medical clearance, and you can't access the outpatient doctor who's going to complete all of that to get you into residential care. You might have access to some types of residential care from outreach workers who are coming out to you, but not more licensed, higher levels of care where most of your, where if your severe needs, they can be met. What you are end up with, left with, is this. Cycling in and out of an ER and an inpatient unit, with the ER and inpatient unit kind of hoping that somebody in the street is helping connecting you to this traditional system of care, but that's kind of really banking on a hope and a wish rather than that structure being built in effectively. Sometimes ERs and inpatients, they might have it, they might find the resource to get someone plugged into a residential level of care, but that's a huge transition for an individual who's been on the street and who is really there monitoring the adjustment of helping manage the anxiety of being in a new environment and maintaining, putting an insurance policy on that residential level of care. There is really no one. That's why even when people are discharged to licensed facilities, there's a very high elopement rate. So when you start looking at this population, who is really meeting their needs? That's where the outreach world and field-based services shine, because they're the missing link between the streets and traditional mental health services. So one way I like to illustrate this is with this, the DMH strategic plan. If you haven't seen the DMH strategic plan, this is what the plan looks like. And I like it for many different reasons, because it helps kind of conceptualize where exactly in the system you are and what direction you should be moving in. So these are the different colors of these circles represents the domains of care where you're going to be interfacing with your clients. So the green domain in the middle is the domain of community services. This is the guiding North Star, where you always want individuals to be in the community, integrated, having a sense of purpose, support structures, having access to all of the resources that they need to build a meaningful life for themselves. That is available in the green over here, where you are integrated within the community. That's where most of the resources are, the most of the infrastructure is, the most of the opportunity lies. The yellow ring beyond that is the crisis care domain. This is where you're interfacing with individuals who are falling out of community. Perhaps they're having a life crisis. Perhaps they're having a mental health crisis, a big change. They are falling out of community and starting to disengage and lose or inappropriately utilize or not utilize the resources that are available to them. And then you finally have this red domain all the way at the end. This is the reentry initiative domain. This is basically individuals who are completely disconnected from community. They could be in the open air asylum of the streets. They could be in the closed air asylum of the jails, or they could even be in the personal asylum of deep isolation. Either way, they are not really connected with community. They have the least infrastructure, the least opportunity, the least amount of structure and evidence-based interventions taking place, and they need the most, the highest level of engagement to get them to the green. So whether you're in the yellow, whether you're in the red, or whether you're in the green, the point is to either get to the green or stay in the green, where you will have the most opportunity available to you. Our DMH directly operated clinics, primary care clinics, the majority of the health system, both mental health and physical health, are located in the green. Between, kind of towards the edge of the green and the yellow is where our FSP teams would lie, where they're trying to make sure that either connect with individuals who are falling out of community or maintain people who are in community. On the red is where our home teams lie. That's where there is very little connection to any sort of community resources. High level of engagement will be needed. Street-based psychiatric services will be needed. A lot of resources will be needed. But the goal is you always should be attempting to move, either if you're in the green, to stay in the green, if you're in the yellow, to push someone into the green, and then if you're in the red, go all the way to the green and develop a strategy to anchor someone in the community. So, if you are in the red, you're completely disconnected from community, who has been reaching out to you to help to support community reintegration? It's been your traditional outreach teams. And the traditional outreach team structure is a community health worker, a substance use counselor, a social worker, generally speaking. The services that a traditional outreach team can provide are case management, outreach services, mental health triage. But when it comes to treatment, you're still required to, you're still going to be limited to linking people to community programs and clinics. And then you're going to run into the same problem. If someone is truly impaired, they might not be able to access outpatient services. So what happened in, at least around 2019 is around the time when I joined DMH is when traditional outreach was undergoing a metamorphosis and it was developing into specialized field-based teams. This would include the home teams, the MDD teams, but basically what happened was in addition to your psychosocial arm of support, a medical arm of support began opening up as well. So in addition to your traditional members, you now had a field-based psychiatrist and a nurse or a psych tech also joining your ranks. Now what that means is in addition to traditional outreach services, you can offer nursing assessments, you can offer psychiatric assessments, medication support and lab workup, housing support, both temporary and permanent, and with teams like specialized FSP such as AOT or with the home team, you can also involve court proceedings for individuals who are failing all levels of care and need legal interventions to help kind of facilitate their recovery for a little bit until they can get on their feet. So let's come back over here. We've kind of said that, okay, if someone is completely disconnected from community, the job of a field-based team and specifically a field-based psychiatrically empowered team is to come from the red to the green. Well, how do you develop, what is the first step of community reintegration for someone who is completely disconnected from community and experiencing chronic homelessness? So building the road to community, if you are street homeless, what is the most important thing to work towards? Doesn't matter what specialty you are, it is working towards stable housing. That is the number one most important thing to work towards. Any intervention you make should be to support stable housing. This is what I tell all the psychiatrists that I work with. Forget about your diagnosis. Forget about your medications. Think about how you are going to help this individual overcome their impairments to work towards stable housing and to help and to work with the team to determine what that stable housing will look like for the individual. You should always be focusing towards independent living and autonomy, 100%. But if an individual is too impaired, they've had schizophrenia untreated all their life, and there's a lot of brain function that might not be able to come back, then you need to figure out what that stable housing level of care is going to look like. But that should be on at the very front of your thoughts, is how am I going to get this person reintegrated with community? So saying that, you know, stable housing is the goal is easy to say, but the truth is we have to developing the road to stable housing is a little bit more complicated for someone who is completely disconnected, severely mentally ill, not in treatment, medically, psychiatrically compromised. The road to stable housing is a little bit more complex, and it's not as simple as offering housing and hoping someone will accept. You will need to stabilize a little bit before you can have a rational discussion about housing. They might not understand the resources you are offering until a level of stabilization is achieved. So how do we do that? At least on the home teams, this is the model that is being utilized. So when you look at field-based management, the first step is screening to make sure you have a clear runway to work with someone on the street. If their liver is failing or their kidneys are failing, you better not keep them on the street to continue, you know, doing field-based management. You might need to elevate the level of care. Screening is the first step. If you're safe to kind of continue working on the street, starting treatment is very important. Treatment can look in many different ways. Outreach, in my opinion, is a form of treatment, building rapport, trust, establishing a foundation of trust with your clients, critically important. Start the treatment, but the treatment should be to stabilize symptoms, to build rapport, establish a bond so you can get someone into housing. Oftentimes, it's easier to get someone into temporary housing first because it's easily accessible and you can quickly address that unsheltered homeless status. But of course, temporary housing is not what we want. We want permanent housing. Even if you put someone in temporary housing, the goal is to ultimately get them into permanent, stable housing, permanent housing. And once even they're in permanent housing, making sure that they are managing that level of care appropriately and they're able to remain and manage the resources at that permanent housing site. Once they're there for about 3 to 4 months, at that point, you can at least say that, look, homelessness is at least in early remission. We can start thinking about a different field-based team that's less intense. The home team would start thinking about transferring someone to FSP at this point, once stable housing is kind of achieved. And then we can say, okay, we were able to kind of move someone from the red to the green. Let's get a different team on board and start working on the next individual who needs our help. That's kind of an overview. We're going to go into specifics now about what each step of the workflow looks like. Okay, so now we're going to go step by step through all of these different steps in this workflow. So screening. Why is screening important? Let's zoom in over there. Screening is important because you want to make sure you're not missing something very serious. People can demonstrate psychosis, hallucinations, delusions, not just for mental health reasons. They can do it for a lot of physical health reasons. If your liver is failing or your kidneys are failing or you have a brain tumor, you can present with mental health symptoms. It's very important to identify if there is something that needs a higher level of care, whether it's medical or psychiatric. You want to do chart review from all of the resources you have. You want to do a lot of digging to make sure there's nothing critical that you're missing. And you don't want to inappropriately keep somebody on the street if they need hospital level services. So once screening is complete, let's say everything is looking good. This individual doesn't have any acute needs that you need to address. You have a little bit of runway to work with them on the streets. That's when you will start your treatment. Now, treatment is what I really wanted to focus in. I'm going to zoom in over here. What does field-based psychiatric treatment look like? I want to emphasize that psychiatry is only one component of treatment, and it's a small component. The entire team has skill sets that are needed for psychiatry to even be utilized. So what I always recommend is developing a strategy where your multidisciplinary team's skill sets are layered in piece by piece, so everyone is at the table to provide wraparound interventions. At least on the home team, the way we do it is, you know, we have a multidisciplinary team. Everything starts with outreach and engagement. In our very core, the home team is an outreach team. And outreach and engagement is the foundation of our entire workflow. Outreach workers, social workers, community health workers, people with lived experience are skilled at building connections with individuals who are experiencing homelessness. They're the first ones that go in and basically establish a bond, establish trust, rapport. Once that's done, the nursing staff is brought in to start doing a nursing assessment, start layering in medical services, getting vitals, building medical rapport, doing a needs assessment to figure out what's going on. Both reports then come to the psychiatrist, who then comes in. Every single skill set is layered in outreach, nursing support, and then psychiatry comes in. Psychiatry has to do an evaluation in a very different way. It's not one that's kind of defined by diagnoses or prior medication trials. It's one that's very humanistic and talking about goals and how the psychiatrist's knowledge and skills and license can help them achieve those goals. If the psychiatrist is successful in building a connection with the individual, getting informed consent, with regards to medications and ordering medications, we actually send the medications to a dedicated pharmacy. This pharmacy creates medication supply in bubble packs that are then delivered to our medication room. And then the team goes out and provides medication support. This is where field-based psychiatry is very different from traditional psychiatry. When someone walks into a clinic, they get a prescription from their psychiatrist, they go fill the prescription, and then they take their own meds. Well, folks in the street cannot do that. So therefore, if you are prescribing someone medications, not only do you have to procure the medications, but you should develop a strategy for that individual to take advantage of your medications and actually access the medication. So we actually go out every single day and deliver medications to people in the street. We observe them self-administer their medication, and we do this over a course of 2 to 3 weeks. It helps develop a sense of structure, a sense of rapport. We bring medications out with other resources and help develop a little bit of a schedule on an environment as unstructured as the streets. Once that's done, the goal of providing the daily medication support is to advance someone to an injection. We can't continue providing medications daily on the street. Eventually, once someone is tolerating medications fairly, you've safely conducted a medication trial on the street, you can advance to a long-acting injection if it is indicated. As symptoms start getting stabilized, we realize that getting someone who's on the street has been likely, their physical health has likely been neglected for decades. So getting laboratory services is very important so we can understand how someone's chemistry on the inside is responding to the environment that they're in. Is there untreated diabetes? Is there heart disease? How are their organs doing? Once that's done, we can also get medical consultation from street medicine. Street psychiatry is, sibling is street medicine. And getting them involved when you identify a health condition is also important. Now you have every single element clicked in. You have outreach and engagement kicked in. You have nursing, you have psychiatry, street psychiatry support, you have laboratory support, you have med support, you have street medicine coming in. Now together, we stabilize all of the different aspects of this person's health and psychosocial needs. That's what I mean by stabilization and how every single resource is layered in. That is field-based psychiatric treatment taking place on the home team. And the elements of how this approach is made, this is logically kind of done. There's no model in the literature that kind of talks about how to do this. This is just it's a logical way to approach someone's health needs. Now, psychiatric interviews for the psychiatrists who are with me today, psychiatric interview techniques that are used on the street are very different from those who are in the hospital or in a clinic. When you're in a hospital or a clinic, the first question a psychiatrist might add is, what brings you to the clinic? You can't go to the streets and ask someone what brings you to the streets. It doesn't really work that way. You have to develop an encounter where one doesn't really exist. Introducing yourself and explaining why you're there is very important. For example, when I go out, I say, hi, my name is Dr. Shai. I'm one of the doctors who works in the streets over here and provides information and support for people's health. Do you have a few minutes to talk about your health? Something like that, and it's not kind of directly jumping into someone's medical history. It's more open-ended and kind of focused on establishing goals and understanding how someone wants to begin the journey of recovery. I always start focusing on immediate needs first. I think it's very important to focus on exactly what an individual needs in that moment. So always asking about, where are you getting your food from? Do you need me to get you some clothing? I notice that they're torn. Where are you sleeping at night? Can I get you any supplies? Do you have any benefits? How are you getting access to income or money to, obtain food or any other resources you might need? And then I take a reverse psychiatric history. I like this a lot. I don't start with past psychiatric admissions, prior diagnoses, prior medication trials, not even medical problems. I kind of like to learn a little bit about their history, where they were born, who raised them, where did they go to high school, did they go to college, did they ever have any type of job? And I use the social history to kind of build rapport, and then I transition into medical problems, which is usually less invasive than psychiatric conditions. And at the very end, I start transitioning into mental health and psychiatric treatment. And even then, I start with something more socially acceptable, less stigmatized, like depression and anxiety and trauma. And then at the very end, I start talking about drugs, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. And sometimes I won't use terms that are highly charged, like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. I'll use more symptoms, such as, do you ever feel like people are following you, trying to get you? Do you ever feel like your moods are unstable, like you can't sleep for a week at a time? More focusing on symptoms rather than diagnosis. So that way it's a little bit more of a conversation than a label that's being put on the individual. I always refrain from asking too invasive questions too quickly. Like I said, I won't just jump into a psychiatric history right away. I'd like to get to know the individual a little bit. by understanding their psychosocial circumstances so I can give context to their medical and psychiatric history. And then avoiding stigmatizing language is very important. If you're a psychiatrist and the individual you're trying to evaluate has been involuntarily hospitalized before, they're terrified of you. They're terrified because they're scared you might get put on a hold, you might say the wrong thing. And it is, I find as a psychiatrist, I often, if someone has been hospitalized several times, I have to go put in the extra effort to build more rapport and not make someone think that I'm just going to reflexively hospitalize them and take their rights away. At the same time, a psychiatric evaluation in the street is very different from one done in an inpatient unit or in a clinic. There are several layers to it. I like to divide them up into pre-evaluation findings, intra-evaluation findings, and post-evaluation findings. One is, before the evaluation, gather as much information as you can. The interview might be very, very short. The individual might not want to talk to you, or they might not know. They might have poor insight, poor judgment. They might not be able to give you a linear kind of run through of what their experience in life has been like. And then also kind of observing from a distance what an individual is doing. Are they walking into traffic? Are they engaging in psychotic behaviors that are kind of, are they responding to internal stimuli? What is going on with their behavior from a distance? Oftentimes people on the street have subacute symptoms where, you know, if you're not directly engaging with them, they start responding to the internal stimuli that's in their mind. But when you start engaging someone, they can gel together and kind of communicate a little bit. But it's important to see what someone's behavior is like when it's not being influenced by your presence. Intra-evaluation findings are findings you would get from the evaluation itself. What are the vital signs looking like? What reports is the patient giving you? What kind of symptoms are you detecting while you're engaging with the client? And then, are they accepting resources that you're providing? If their clothes are soiled and you offer them clothes or other resources, once rapport has been established, are they accepting those resources from you? And then there's post-evaluation findings. Once that evaluation is completed, what was the behavior like? Did the individual get very traumatized? Did it trigger some sort of a response in them and they weren't able to handle the encounter? And also, did they utilize the resources that you provided rationally? I've given people who are looking emaciated food. They've accepted it in the moment, but then when I've walked away and looked from a distance, they've thrown the food away without actually utilizing it. So it's important to not only take note of acceptance of resources, but how are the resources being utilized? A psychiatrist always needs to gather a lot of information, and it's very important for psychiatrists to maintain data organization when they are speaking to someone on the streets. It's loud, it's difficult to hear, people might be interrupting what you're saying. I like to use something like this to help develop a systematic approach to note-taking in the field. If you notice, the information on the right-hand side is all social history, living situation, childhood, relationships, education. I will always start on this side first to help warm someone up to my presence. It's a conversational interview. It's not very clinical. And then once I build a little bit of rapport, I'll start going into allergies, family history, medical history, and then their psychiatric history and drug use. But I don't like to jump into that right away. On the street, it's also very important to make a rapid diagnosis. That's the whole point that you're there, is to identify how you can help this individual. You can't help someone as a psychiatrist without knowing what you are treating or which direction you're going in. But the most important thing to first do is figure out whether you're working with a psychiatric disorder or a medical condition. There are very specific ways to do this, but if someone is disoriented, they don't know what year it is, where they are, who they are, they're not really alert or oriented, there is a very high likelihood that you're dealing with a medical condition. Typically, orientation, attention is kind of maintained in psychiatric conditions typically. But if someone is confused and disoriented, you might be working, even if they look like they're hallucinating and responding, that might be coming out of a medical condition. Once you've established that you're working with a psychiatric disorder, you will run through your assessment. You'll run through a psychiatric diagnostic assessment to figure out what condition you're working with and then treat it appropriately. A few words on medications. There's many different types of psychiatric medications, but we can't use all of them on the streets for a variety of reasons. The primary, you have antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, antidepressants, MAT, or the medication-assisted treatment for substance use. And then you also have PRN medications, which are also as-needed medications. Out of these medications, what you can imagine is the main ones that we're using on the streets are antipsychotics and substance use-related medications. We're not using mood stabilizers because mood stabilizers require blood monitoring. We don't have phlebotomy being accessed regularly on the streets, so it can be very dangerous to have these medications on someone who is on the streets. Plus, lithium also has a very tight window there's a very tight window of what the blood level needs to be. And if someone's dehydrated or not eating properly, those levels can be thrown off. So it can be dangerous. Depakote would be a little bit more safe, but lithium in particular, very dangerous. Antidepressants. They can be they're safe to use, but you got to take them every single day. There's no antidepressant long-acting injection. It has to be taken every single day. And how long do they take to work? 4 to 6 weeks. You know, that's a long time of daily medication administration for something to work. So it's not, I don't consider it until I get someone at least into temporary housing. As needed medication, I mean, they can be helpful for anxiety or sleep, but what else can they do? They can make you sleepy. If they make you sleepy, groggy, what's going to happen? You can get attacked. You can get assaulted. You can fall. You can hit your head. There's a lot of danger of using medications that can make you sleepy. So antipsychotics and medication-assisted treatment, naltrexone, Vivitrol, and Narcan is what we primarily use. And there's many different types of antipsychotics. Which ones do we like to use? We like to use the ones that all have LAIs, which stands for long-acting injections. And I'll tell you, out of these three, which one I prefer to use. I actually, what are some of the dangers of being on the street? You do not want to make someone sedated. You do not want them to gain weight because, believe it or not, they're not serving grain bowls on Skid Row. They're serving very high-calorie foods. And if you have a medication that causes weight gain, it's going to cause a whole bunch of metabolic abnormalities. You also don't want a medication that causes too much EPS, which is muscle stiffness from antipsychotics, because if you become really stiff on the streets, you might not be accessing what little resources you were accessing before. So Abilify ends up being my go-to choice on the street because it's actually an energizing medication. So I can give it in the morning without fear of someone becoming sleepy or loopy during the day. It doesn't cause any weight gain. So I'm at least rest assured that I won't give them diabetes or may give them metabolic syndrome based on the diet they're eating on the street. It doesn't cause that much. The risk for EPS and akathisia is low, and it has an injection. Here's that point that I'm going to come back to. What was the second leading cause of death for individuals who are on the street in LA County? Heart disease. Antipsychotics can cause arrhythmias of the heart, but Abilify has the best cardiac profile, which means that it is least likely to cause arrhythmias, and you can give it more safely to individuals without having an EKG or a medical evaluation of their heart. So it ends up being my go-to medication where I start. If it doesn't work, then I'll switch gears to Risperidone or Haldol. This is an example of how I'll do medications on the street. And by the way, if there are non-medical staff in this meeting, I would recommend it's very important that we all know a little bit about each other's specialties. So even though I'm talking about medications, it's important for you to understand the concepts. Even if you don't understand the milligrams, you should understand the logic behind how these medications are being selected. So if you see an odd medication regimen for someone, trigger should be going off that you might want to bring this to the attention of your psychiatrist. If they're getting sleepy, the medications are making them oversedated. Everybody on the team should have some basic medical first aid type knowledge when it comes to the streets. So for Abilify, I start with 7.5 milligrams. I give that for 4 days. I increase it to 15 milligrams for another 4 days. After about 8 to 10 days of them tolerating that medication, I'll then provide an injection. So usually after starting an oral medication, for about 10 to 14 days, I'll give an oral medication to make sure they're tolerating it, go provide daily deliveries, build rapport, develop a schedule, kind of make sure that we have a routine going, and then I advance to an injection. And believe it or not, people aren't excited to get injections on the street. No one's saying, yes, give me this LAI. It takes a while to convince someone to take an injection, and it, that happens through rapport building. All right, so this is, we have kind of gone through all of our, I've kind of walked you through the different types, the different pieces in place for our treatment component. Let's zoom out and let's start talking about why we're doing treatment. We're doing treatment to work to, so we can have, we can stabilize mental health symptoms, to improve insight and judgment, so we can have a rational discussion about housing. It is very important for psychiatrists to be trained on placement, and they're really not. I spend a lot of my time helping psychiatrists understand the different levels of care that are available. So let's look at temporary housing options. Within the best way to kind of categorize this is temporary and permanent. And within temporary, you have unlicensed facilities. What that basically means is they're not licensed. There's no treatment component included on the site. That could be a motel, a shelter, or an interim housing program. These are both basically a place to stay, but there's no treatment included. If you have a field-based psychiatric team connected to you, this is great because now you can provide the treatment. And the good thing about unlicensed facilities is that they usually just require forms. You low barrier, you can quickly get someone in. Within temporary housing, you also have licensed facilities. And those are board and cares. They're different types of board and cares. You have CRTP or crisis residential where you can go for 1 month, and then enhanced residential services, ERS, where you can stay for 9 months. But both of these, because they're licensed board and care facilities, they require forms, interviews, physician reports, labs for medical clearance, which you might not readily be able to access. So it's not unusual for me to quickly get someone into an unlicensed facility. I really do like IHP because it gives me a lot of runway for the amount of time someone can be there. But if someone is unable to really kind of, you know, if you go into an interim housing program like the Russ on Skid Row, but you're not really even leaving your room to go get food, it can be potentially dangerous. So you don't want to put someone into a level of care where they're not accessing the resources they need. Because on the street, someone, they might have had a community member who was bringing them food. You pick that person up and you put them into an interim housing program where they don't know how to access their food and they're not getting it correctly, you could do more harm. So it's important that when you put someone in a level of care, you make sure that you're not destroying whatever little system they have to access their basic needs. Licensed facilities are great because you have medical and psychiatric services being offered on site. But you will need to overcome all of this gatekeeping stuff that they have. That's why sometimes I access temporary licensed housing only when someone is coming out of a hospital. Because at that point, you can kind of get the bed ready, but the hospital can complete a lot of the labs and physician reports and things that you need. I personally am working on developing a mobile phlebotomy service for DMH so we can do all of this from the street. And you really don't need to go to a higher level of care just to get access to board and cares or licensed residential facilities. So temporary housing, I will keep someone. The goal is, however, whenever someone is ready to move into permanent housing, that's the goal. That's when you should move to permanent housing. And some people are not ready for that. Some people like the temporary housing setup, but we're always talking about moving people into permanent housing. What are the real permanent housing options that we have? You have the unlicensed facility is permanent supportive housing. That is the goal. You want people to live independently in the community and to have autonomy. And have privacy. That's not something that everyone who is severely mentally ill is able to do. The goal is if they can, they should. But if they're not, ERC is a long-term board and care setup. But unfortunately, it has the same gatekeeping problems that board and cares in the temporary housing option had. You need forms, interviews, physician reports, and labs. The one thing that I think is really sad is if you put someone in this board and care, they will lose their homeless status and you will not be able to get them a housing voucher for permanent supportive housing. So if you decide to curse someone to a board and care, you better be really sure that that's the level of care that they need, because if they start getting better and now you want them to live independently, you might not be able to move them into permanent supportive housing because they've lost their homeless status. That's a policy related issue that I think everyone is working on changing, but that is something you have to remember, at least for if you're a psychiatrist, if you're moving someone to a board and care, remember that you might not have the luxury of moving into permanent supportive housing if they're capable of independent living down the line, which they might be. Now, permanent housing, once you're in a permanent housing setting, disengaging at that point and just handing the baton to a different team doesn't make sense. You really want to observe someone in the permanent setting for at least 3 to 4 months to ensure that they are stably housed. And again, whatever the goal is, ultimately to get someone to stable housing, whether you're doing a drop-in center, you're doing street psychiatry, whatever you're doing, working towards stable housing should be a very real goal that, it, you know, if your team is capable of doing that, it should definitely be put on, like it should be at the front of your mind. However, despite your best efforts, your street-based or field-based management might not work. And it might not work for a variety of reasons. The treatment might not be strong enough. They might be refusing treatment. They might be, despite being on treatment, you might not be resolving the insight and judgment sufficiently enough for someone to move into housing. They might be repeatedly falling out of housing for whatever reason, it might not be working. That's when you start realizing that even though you have this primary recovery pathway that you're working on, people might start developing a crisis. They might start developing acute needs. What do you do then? That's where you need to start realizing if there's field-based or street treatment failure, you might need to have a partnered inpatient facility that understands, that you have relationships with, that will accept your patients, that will allow you to come, your field-based psychiatrist to come in and co-evaluate the patients with them to stabilize symptoms together by giving reports from the field. As I said, as a street psychiatrist, I regularly go to visit my folks in inpatient facilities. I meet their psychiatrists. I let them know, hey, look, this is the reality they're living in. I don't think this medication will work. I would recommend this one if you're in agreement. You stabilize the patient together. But here's the best part. You provide a warm reception at the inpatient facility. They're not strangers who are taking care of you. There's people, it's people that the individual knows from the street. It's a familiar face in the hospital. And then we start talking about housing. The moment symptoms stabilize in the hospital, we start talking and providing education on the importance of housing and developing options that the individual is somewhat comfortable with. Not if they're living in downtown, don't give them a place in Long Beach. Like, we try and create the stability of an environment that they're used to, so that way they're more likely to accept and remain in that housing. And once discharge takes place, they're getting discharged back to your recovery plan. Whether it's in temporary housing or permanent housing, the hospital then becomes a consultant that's helping you manage the crisis. And this doesn't have to be an inpatient admission. It could be an urgent care. Regardless of what level of care you're elevating to, you go and co-manage the patient. It needs to be a partnered facility where you as a field-based team can go in and manage that patient's needs together with that facility. So it's not just a stranger doing it. It's an extension of your team. And if everything, you could do that a couple of times, but if everything fails, then you would need to have relationships with a team that is able to activate court proceedings. AOT and the home team are examples of two DMH field-based teams that can activate court proceedings, where AOT can activate AOT and get assisted outpatient treatment where they can mandate treatment. Home team can do full-on outpatient conservatorship. But you have to realize that if you're going to refer the case to a team that is able to engage with the court and public guardian, then they will need to see all of this again. You can't just recommend conservatorship and then hand the case over to the home team. The home team has to, the individual has to fail the home team model before home team can create a justification and testify to seeing all of that failure, and then in front of a judge. So kind of just calling something, referring for outpatient conservatorship is not really a thing. Saying that they're failing our level of care, we'd like a higher level of care, that makes sense. And the home team will need to assess whether or not conservatorship is indicated. You can definitely provide some thoughts that, hey, I suspect it's going towards that direction. But we would, any street psychiatrist that's going to testify in court needs to see the failures with their own eyes so they can testify without hearsay being called in court. This is, if you have all of these elements, you can get someone from street homelessness to stable housing, you know, either voluntarily or through inpatient stabilization or with the facilitation of the court. This is my favorite part. I have permission from Public Guardian and from the patients to share this. This is using the model that I just shared. This is the results that we had had. Here's an individual who we started out with on the street, and this was them. Afterwards, this stabilization was done fully outpatient. We did not use any hospitalization to get this, and this individual is fully conserved. This next individual, this is how we engaged with them on the street at first. After stabilization, they were placed into an open setting. This individual was briefly hospitalized. They found a lot of utility in the work we had done. Some of them even got reunited with family, and they really wanted to share in the education of how the system that we are using. Here are some of my references. I noticed a question, hearsay. Yeah, hearsay is terrible because if you haven't seen something with your own eyes, it didn't exist in the eyes of the court. So that's what makes things tricky. If one team thinks that conservatorship is needed, a different team that's actually doing the conservatorship that holds no meaning for them, they actually have to see failures themselves so they can talk about it in court. Hopefully they will update that at some point, but that hearsay makes conservatorship very challenging, and we can't utilize each other's experiences. We have to do it from the ground up. How do you monitor med compliance in the street? We actually, we deliver medications every single day, and we observe individual self-manage medication. So I will go to the street. I will go to my patient every single day. Here's your medication. Please open it up and take it. I'll observe them take it. That's how we know. We actually observe the self-administration of medication, so we know they're being compliant. And once we observe that compliance for at least maybe a week or two, then we will give an injection. And when we give the injection, we know they're being compliant. What do you recommend for clients with severe mental illness, substance abuse, that refuse FSP services, refuse home services, refuse medications, but continue to have mental health crises and frequent psychotic symptoms? The most important thing over here, first thing would be to get some diagnostic clarity. Are you working with a substance use disorder, or is there an underlying schizophrenia spectrum that would be present even if the drugs are not there? It sounds like this person is failing everything. If home team services are unique, because if you refuse our services for long enough, you will be conserved because you're not benefiting from everything. You're severely impaired. And you're kind of not addressing your basic needs. So the home team, our whole job is to work with individuals who are refusing services, because we can access outpatient conservatorship and facilitate the recovery in the setting of refusals. But home team is very, outpatient conservatorship is only for a subset of individuals who are not at risk of repeatedly eloping from facilities because of drug use. We can only put people in open settings. So for someone like that, they'd probably need to be evaluated for traditional conservatorship if they're at high risk for elopements and running away from facilities. To refer a client to guardianship, I think by guardianship is a term that's used on the East Coast sometimes. In LA, guardianship can mean probate conservatorship or LPS conservatorship. For mental health, we'll be doing LPS conservatorship. And yes, you have to... it has to be through mental health court. That's the court that manages LPS conservatorship in LA. Anything else? I guess, the most important thing that I wanted to get across is that it's always a team-based approach. Psychiatry needs to adapt and try and understand how to utilize the multiple different skill sets in the mental health system. I think doctors are kind of used to just running the show. That's just not the case when you're working with someone who needs access to all the resources that a mental health system has to offer. And one of the core things that I teach psychiatrists is how to work in a team and make sure that you're utilizing all of the skill sets. The psychiatrist can be the architect of a treatment plan, but you still need the rest of the team to kind of execute that plan. And how do you kind of develop a plan by bringing your skill sets to the table, but still making sure that every team member's opinion is valued and kind of, utilized in making the final decision. So if you have street psychiatrists who are in need of training, you can always, utilize me. I'm always doing trainings to help them understand these concepts. But, a lot of psychiatrists who are coming to the street, they need to unlearn what they've been taught in residency. And that's a lot of what I do. So if you do feel like, you have a street psychiatrist who can benefit from the training, you can send them my way. All right. That's what I got for you guys.
Thank you so, so much. And anyone else that wants to continue these conversations, we have a monthly psychiatrist NP learning exchange. That's a great place to do so with a number of minds who are doing this type of work. All right. Thanks so much. Thanks for staying over. And thank you everyone for the wonderful questions.